Good evening. I was just thinking about what brings us to practice. And it feels like there's two main things that bring us here. From the position of the relative, we come here because life is difficult and we struggle and we want companionship, you know, while we navigate just the difficulty of being in this form. And that's really great. It's really wonderful that we do that. And I think also from the position more from the absolute, we come because we know we're so much more than all of those struggles of daily life. We know that there's something pure and good and huge, and we want to try and inhabit that a little more. So in a way, we come here to kind of try and remember who we are, who we really are, or who we really aren't. And I think it's a little difficult because on an ordinary level, it really does appear as if we are a separate, discrete object in space. You know, it really does. You see this body every morning. We watch our hands change over time. So it's difficult to not fall into the trap of feeling that we really are just a product of the past in this particular life and the events that have happened to us. The habit of mind is just so strong to think that we are what we've done and that we'll be in the future whatever happens next. And I think when life is going quite well, which often happens for people, usually it starts to change often, 40s and 50s, but often life can go pretty well, then identifying with that as who you are is not too bad. I think people do all right with that. There's daily irritations, there's occasional setbacks, there's periods of things sort of not going well, but then one picks oneself up again and gets back on track, and the illusion of progress and the sense that by the end of this life certain things will have been achieved is, you know, fairly believable and fairly plausible for people. And I think a lot of people do that. And that can be okay. But it's also a little bit precarious if things don't continue going well like that. When they stop going well like that, and if you identify yourself as being a good person because of what you have done, or anything within that kind of ballpark, then when things go wrong, the whole sense of our identity then starts to crumble, and that's extremely painful. And that happens. I was thinking about the story of the Buddha, and when he realized about sickness and old age and death, and he realized how dangerous it was actually for him to stay in such a privileged life. You know, at that point, it's like, oh, this is not a good idea. So if I stay in that sort of life and don't really examine more closely what's going on, if I don't really look at impermanence, then at some point all of this wonderful stuff is going to go away. So things going well for us is also a little bit of a problem, as well as things going badly for us. And if our life is really difficult, and because there are so many inequities in life and so many people, no matter how hard they try, no matter how well intended, how intelligent, how kind and caring their families are, they may be in some part of the economic structure or cultural biases that just mean they don't get ahead. They just can't move forward in the material world or in the world of form. And if people identify with that as being their fault, that's also just terribly tragic. And I think that happens a great deal too. But for those of us who have had the opportunity to recognize the Dharma, have heard the teachings, then when things do go really badly for us, that provides us with a great opportunity to deepen our practice. And to go, oh yeah, that's right, I've forgotten. I know I'm not all those things. I know I'm not those things. I keep thinking I am, but actually I'm not. And there's, I think, a very strong motivation to not identify with the events of your life when things have gone badly, because otherwise you're going to come to the conclusion that you're maybe not a very good person. And that would be completely to miss our Buddha nature to do that. That would be just inaccurate. So how do we go about dismantling this habit, this delusion of identifying with what is happening around us as who we are? Well, we do zazen. That's the main thing that we do here. Because when we're doing zazen, we kind of unhinge ourselves from all of that content for a period of time, and we just sit. We just sit without all of the stories, without all of the people in our lives, and we're just present. And being present with the present moment has a quality of peace and expansiveness to it. So doing zazen helps us break that identification. And practicing leading a good life, following the Eightfold Path of right view and right action, right speech, right livelihood, right concentration. Yesterday in our Dogen study group over breakfast, something came up when we were talking about the four, I think it's called, we called it the four virtues, four immeasurables of compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it was a really lovely conversation that we had about that. And when we practice compassion, this is another way in which we remember that we're actually totally interconnected, because when we're feeling compassion, we're completely merging with the suffering of another person, and feeling very fully for them, their pain, and recognizing them as ourselves. Maybe merging with them might not be the best way of putting it, but we're recognizing them as ourselves. And when we feel loving kindness, we're doing the same thing. We're just generously, well, it's not even generous because it's to ourselves, that we're saying, oh, here, have this, or here, can I help you? Just naturally expressing our Buddha nature right there and seeing ourselves as no different to anybody else. And particularly with sympathetic joy. I love sympathetic joy. I think I'm quite good at it, in fact. I feel very happy for other people's happiness. That's a wonderful thing to cultivate, to be just genuinely happy for someone else's good fortune. But actually, when we do that, there's actually a little piece of going, oh, I hope you don't get too attached to that, because that will pass. But you don't say that bit. Don't say that bit. You just go, oh, I'm so excited. You got into the course. That's wonderful. Oh, you got a job. That is so great. And equanimity. With equanimity, we are just at ease because there's nothing to do, no place to go, because we are already at one with everything as it is. So another way to help break this habit of thinking that we are a separate self that is defined by things that have happened to us is that we study the sutras. And in the warming the hearth, we are studying some of the Pali canon. And I wanted to read out just a section. I'm not sure if we've got to this or not. It's in the section of the human condition, and it's the vicissitudes of life, and it is comparing an uninstructed worldling to an instructed noble disciple, of which we are all both. So we're the uninstructed worldling when we think that we are a separate self and we're identifying with things from the past and we're imagining that we will be all right in the future when we achieve our goals, then things will be fine. That's when we're being an uninstructed worldling, and we're being an instructed noble disciple when we are not attaching ourselves to any of those things. So this is written in the masculine, and I tried thinking about saying he, she, but there's just too many he's in here to say he, she, so I will read it as it is and on the very last sentence say he, she. And this actually starts with the eight worldly conditions, which is, I think, what I talked about last time and which we talked about last year a little bit in the discussion group that was meeting next door. So these eight worldly conditions, monks, keep the world turning around, and the world turns around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. These eight worldly conditions, monks, are encountered by an uninstructed worldling, and they are also encountered by an instructed noble disciple. Now, what is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between an instructed noble disciple and an uninstructed worldling? When an uninstructed worldling, monks, comes upon gain, he does not reflect thus. This gain that has come to me is impermanent, bound up with suffering, subject to change. He does not know it as it really is. And when he comes upon loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, he does not reflect on them thus. All these are impermanent, bound up with suffering, subject to change. He does not know them as they really are. With such a person, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, keep his or her mind engrossed. So I imagine someone other than me in this room has been completely engrossed by the events of their life, and it's not very nice at all to be engrossed by the details of one's life. When gain comes, he is elated, and when he meets with loss, he is dejected. When fame comes, he is elated, and when he meets with disrepute, he is dejected. When he experiences pleasure, he is elated, and when he experiences pain, he is dejected. Thus being involved in likes and dislikes, he will not be freed from birth, aging and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection and despair. He will not be freed from suffering, I say. But monks, when an instructed noble disciple comes upon gain, he reflects thus. This gain has come to me as impermanent, bound up with suffering and subject to change. And so he will reflect when loss and so forth come upon him. He understands all these things as they really are, and they do not engross his mind. Thus he will not be elated by gain or dejected by loss, elated by fame or dejected by disrepute, elated by praise or dejected by blame, elated by pleasure or dejected by pain. Having thus given up likes and dislikes, he will be freed from birth, aging and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection and despair. He will be freed from suffering, I say. So I was thinking about this and about the role of likes and dislikes in this whole process of identification with events. And a funny thing sort of happened a few weeks ago. It certainly wasn't intended. It just kind of snuck up on me. And I just woke up one morning and decided to become vegan. And I want to just describe a little bit about what that was like. It was so interesting. Because instead of thinking, oh, look, I think I really should do this thing. Like, I know I should do this thing. It wasn't all like that. I've got some friends who are very strong vegans, and they've been encouraging me for ages. And I've been saying to them, look, I completely know that it makes sense that I should do it. I just don't want to do it right now. I completely know about the suffering of animals. I completely know what goes on in the industry. I'm fully aware of it, but I'm just not going to do that right now. And they've actually said to me that they found me the nicest non-vegan around, because at least they didn't think I was trying to justify my position. I was just like, I know I'm completely doing the wrong thing from that perspective, but I'm sorry, I just am where I'm at right now. But even as I said that, there was a part of me going like, oh, that's a little bit, I don't know. This didn't quite feel right, but, you know, that's just where I was at. And then it just crept up on me and said to me, okay, today's the day. And it was completely different, because it has nothing to do with self-discipline or lack. I felt very different in this process, because I started off from a place of feeling extremely abundant. You know, like, well, I can drink clean water. How about that? That's so amazing. Water. Then on top of water, besides I'm already pure Buddha, lacking nothing at all already, but on top of that, if I would like, I can drink water. I can have apple juice, orange juice, carrot juice. I can go buy a blender from Target, put all things into it, kale. You know, I can then have like solid things like apples, oranges, bananas. I can have carrots, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cucumbers, tomatoes. If you started spreading it out, it would just completely begin to fill this zendo, the things that you could have. There's nuts, so many different nuts, dried fruit. And I've noticed that I don't even need to go near the stove. Like, you just don't even need to cook if you don't feel like it. I'm fairly lazy. I'm just not that interested in food. I tend to have food just put in the calories, keep going with my day. I don't have a strong kind of... some people, I think, must have very good taste buds, and so for them food's very exciting and they love the process of cooking. But I love a whole bunch of other processes, and cooking's not particularly one of them. So this has just been like, great. Dried fruit, dried nuts, some sticks of celery, a few carrots, apple, my God, I'm done. So that's been very interesting. And I noticed that it has, it started to quieten down certain sort of likes and dislikes aspect that I was having a lot of trouble with. And I think food can be very useful, examining food can be very useful that way, because I think a lot of us use food in multiple ways. Like in our meal service, we say, I eat this food to
support life.
I eat this food to support life. And if we eat food to support life, then we're thinking about nutrition, because if we're going to go out and be of benefit to the world, then we need to have nutrition in our body. That's what's important. And nutrition comes with some calories, but the primary thing we're wanting is nutrition so that we can go out there and do the things that we do. In the Diamond Sangha, the Meal Sutra actually says, we eat this food to save our bodies from emaciation, which is very powerful, actually. And I would say, I used to be able to say that very comfortably, we eat this food to save our bodies from emaciation. But more recently, I found it harder to say that, because I know that's not why I've been eating food at all. I haven't been eating it to save my body from emaciation. I've been eating it because I've been finding life too difficult and I want to have comfort. So I eat for comfort. And often when we eat for comfort, we're not eating nutritiously. We're eating just calories, just eating stuff. And to eat for comfort, which is a little bit like coping, which is a little bit like escaping, is all around not accepting the present moment for what it is and trying to evade what is actually arising. So I'm sort of very glad that whatever you call it, little veganism Buddha or whatever, knocked on my door and said, hello, today's the day. And it's just like I go somewhere and say, is there anything vegan here? And they say no, and I go, okay. I'm like, okay. It's not like, oh, Jesus, why don't you get something, you know, like Santa Cruz. It's just like, okay, well, that's fine. I did suggest to the Bagelry, which is a very good place to go, that they get Earth Balance, which is a vegan butter alternative. It would be very simple for them to get and very nice for those of us who do like to have bagels with butter. So I did suggest that, but it didn't bother me at all that they didn't have it. It just didn't matter. So if I can become less concerned and attached to what foods I'm eating in terms of choosing particular ways to get nutrition, then hopefully that will help me be more accepting of other places where I don't have much choice. There's lots of places where we don't have much choice. We have to accept certain conditions in our life, things that happen with our children, things that happen in our workplace, things that happen to our bodies. We need to develop a way to just be accepting. I had a topic that for another talk, but I wanted to mention it because I just think it's very interesting. And it actually connects to something that a conversation that we had in an email about reality. The thought that I had was that if we identify with reality as who we are, if we strongly do that, then we're probably also strongly going to be compelled to want to distort reality to better serve our ego. And the less we identify with the world as us, as a separate individual self, then the more likely we'll be able to see what is actually transpiring with some clarity, as much as any of us can be clear about anything that's happening in the physical world. But we would be more likely to see it with a less discriminating mind if we're not attaching that to our ego. Just a thought. I wanted to, just before opening it up for conversation, mention a small koan from a collection called the Miscellaneous Collection. It's not a published collection. It was compiled by Harada and Yasutani Roshi, and it's used in the Diamond Sangha as a kind of, it's a small collection of short koans that students work with before they start working with the main collections, you know, the Mamong Koan and Book of Serenity and Blue Cliff Record, and so on. And there's one in there that I really like, and it goes, with hands of emptiness, I take hold of the plow. As I walk, I ride the water buffalo. As I cross the bridge flows. The water is still. And I just love this image of, with hands of emptiness, I take hold of the plough. You know, if you think about ploughing a field with the plough and it's attached to the ox or the horse, we do have to function every day, doing things every day. We have to get up and engage in our work and so on. There's just, even if we're living in a monastery, we still have roles and responsibilities. But we can do that with hands of emptiness. And we can do that with hands of emptiness. We can pick up that plough. We can brush our teeth. As I walk, I ride the water buffalo. And it's in a similar sense. We walk. Our feet carry us every day, a great deal of the day. I like the way when we walk in here, we've got this path and there's the bamboo on one side and they're called camellias? Camellias on that side and the altar. And we kind of enter this corridor. We bow at the altar and come into the Zendo. I just want to read just a few comments about the water buffalo, because the water buffalo is an important image in Zen, and this is just a commentary on a different case, but it's about the water buffalo. This is the water buffalo or water. The water buffalo or water ox is an important member of the household for farming families throughout Asia. It pulls the plough through the mud of the rice fields and enriches them with manure. Its power and placid disposition give it a place in the Buddhist pantheon with the lion of Manjushri and the elephant of Samantabhadra. I like that. Power and placid disposition. Its figure is sometimes found with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas on Zen Buddhist altars. On the altar, the water buffalo is the ox of the 10 ox herding pictures, a series of symbolic images found in a number of English Zen texts. In that series, the ox represents essential nature. It is sought, followed, glimpsed, captured, tamed, and ultimately forgotten. And in the 10th picture, the herdsman enters the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands, his bag full of candy and toys for the children. And right now I feel like let's just change that to sort of like nuts and fruit for the children. So as we walk, we are riding on the back of the buffalo, which is our true nature. As we cross the bridge moves. This is a description of how the bridge and ourselves are not separate and are not different. And even just on a logical level, the bridge exists because humans need to cross water. And they came up with this idea and they built one. And so the bridge can exist because humans thought of it. And humans are able to move from one side of the river to the other because there is a bridge. So even just on that logical level, just in the, from the realm of form, the bridge and the human are dependent on each other and invent each other. A human couldn't do that thing without the bridge. The bridge wouldn't be there without the human. But on a more essential level, there's really no distinction between ourselves and the bridge. So when we move, the bridge is moving. And then the last line of this koan is, the water is still. And I think this is speaking to the stillness that is in activity, because of course water generally is bubbling along and doing its thing. It's generally not really still. But we can be still within our activity, just like we do with our mudra. We have equanimity sitting on action. So I just wanted to share one last thing. There's this wonderful documentary on Netflix on Instant Watch called Sunrise, Sunset, about a day in the life of the Dalai Lama. And it just actually just follows him through his day. And it's extraordinarily humbling to watch his day. Has anyone seen that documentary? You know, when I think I don't have time for Zazen or time to read, you know, you watch the Dalai Lama and he hours every day without fail, you know. He does his bowing, he does his meditation and then sutra study. And then he has a treadmill and he does his running on the treadmill. And then he sees people day or hour after hour after hour, seeing people. It's wonderful to watch. But at one part, near the beginning actually, he says this thing. I was thinking about how we think about being in the present moment. And he was saying, well, you have 1 minute and you break 1 minute up into seconds. And you break seconds up into milliseconds, and you look very closely, and you have the millisecond that just went past, millisecond that's about to happen. There's no millisecond in the middle. Like, we don't even have the present to hang on to. We don't even have that, you know. We don't even have that. So, like, not only can we not only is not a good idea because it's not accurate to identify with form as who we are, and that it is a wonderful thing to be very present, but we actually don't even have that. Okay. Would anyone like to comment or ask a question? Yes, Jamie?
I met someone who said he was now a former Buddhist. I asked him why he was a former Buddhist. He said, I got so good at unattaching that my moment became empty and I forswore my art. And I felt so holy and so empty that I couldn't keep doing that. I'm struck by what he said, and I'm struck by the contradiction in Buddhism between the command or the injunction to be compassionate, that is to be, as I understand it, part of the reality of the other person, to go into that reality, and yet not be attached to it and not be caught in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand it as. And there are whole books about Buddhist activism that talk about this problem. I just wondered if you could comment how I go about being compassionate and not being part of the person's reality. I don't know how to do that.
How to be compassionate and not part of their reality? Like not to merge too much with their reality?
Or not. Yeah, whatever you would suggest.
Well, it sounds like your friend has the opposite problem of being detached, right? And I think that's a common topic that comes up, the distinction between detachment and non-attachment. And it's incredibly important, in my understanding, to distinguish between those two things, because to detach is to have the idea that there is someone who can detach and something to be detached from. Whereas non-attachment is, in a way, we can't ever, if we believe the teachings, we're not separate from anything, so we can't detach from it, but we can be non-attached to outcomes. We can be non-attached to outcomes, recognizing that form isn't permanent, that it's always going to change, and anything we may want to have happen may happen but may not happen. And anything that's arisen in a way that we feel pleased about isn't going to continue being that way. So we can be non-attached to wanting things to be other than how they actually are. So that would seem to make sense to maybe just say something like that to your friend. But in terms of how not to feel so too much pain when someone else is suffering, is that part of what you were saying?
I don't know whether it's just pain, because there's not only pain there when I have pain when I go into the reality of the person, but the act of compassion appears to be to include being a part of their experience enough to get that, and to, because I get that, be obvious to the other person that I want their suffering to be less.
Right.
I don't know how to do that without being fairly...
Right.
What the word is, attached or involved.
Probably it's attached to the outcomes too much. Like, I think we want the best for other people, just as we want the best for ourselves, and we can take every action that we're able to, given the circumstances of our life, to help bring that about, and that's as far as we can go. It's just as far as we can go. We can't make it happen. And if we spend too much time being tormented by ours or another person's suffering, when we're already doing what we can, then that is when we're being too attached to the outcome, I think, in my understanding of things, or just in my experience of things.
This actually came up, this part problem came up yesterday morning when we were discussing this issue. And I thought what you said about sympathy and empathy was wonderful. So I think I'd like to hear you repeat that here in terms of what you just said and what you said yesterday.
I can kind of nearly remember what I said, but can't quite. Yeah. Can you do it? Could you say it for me?
What you did is that when we were talking about this thing about feeling compassion for somebody completely, but not losing your identity in the feeling compassion for them, you defined sympathy and empathy, which I bet you can define now better than I could try to repeat. And then we talked about, you know, the problems that can arise from that, of which this thing that you're now talking about, you know, not attachment to the outcome, of course, is very important. But I just thought the sympathy and empathy helped kind of define the dilemma.
Mm. So there's a couple of different definitions of sympathy and empathy. I'm trying to remember how we said it yesterday. One way with sympathy is that you feel for someone, but you're not really recognizing them as a variant, like as yourself. So you feel sympathy for them as a separate object. Empathy is more when you feel for them as yourself, but it's a good idea to maintain some of your own cognition and not completely let your emotions get caught with that person, because it's not going to actually benefit them if you let your yourself completely merge with them with all your emotion. Then you're not being of use to them, which is not as compassionate as maintaining a certain amount of separateness so that you can think clearly to act in their best interest. Does that feel okay compared to yesterday? Okay.
Perfect.
But that reminds me of something else from yesterday that was really wonderful. A description of, in a way that relates to all of this, of that Kokyo gave of life being that we are like steering a boat. The boat exists in the elements of the water and the currents, and the wind blowing, and the sun beating down, and the rain, and we don't have control of those things. We don't have control of those things, but we can steer the boat and adjust the sail, so we're functioning in response. And if we skillfully functioning in response is being very present, because you can't do that if you're thinking about something else. So I thought that was a beautiful image, and it came up from the word life driving, which was an interesting word. But Edie.
In a simple way, can you describe how caring and wanting to be helpful and compassion come out of unattachment?
Okay. Well,
how does it arise?
Right. Well, I guess I would say like non-attachment, just to be clear about not detached or unattached, but non-attached.
Non-attached.
Non-attached is still when we're recognizing everything as ourself, because if we can't detach from ourself. So just by knowing that everything is ourself, where we can't be attached or detached from it, because that would suggest that there's two things. So we actually are non-attached. And then if we act with compassion, which naturally flows out of seeing everything as ourself, like.
That's the question. How and why does it flow naturally out of?
Oh, okay. Well, so this is something I say to co-parents when I work with co-parents, so divorced couples who have children. To see themselves as one body, is one hand here, there's one hand here, and they each hold the hand of the child to walk through that child's life. They don't want to attack the other hand. Like it's not a good idea, you know, to cut your own hands, to cut the hands of the same body. And in the same way, I think we just naturally moved. The more we realize that that there is no separation between us and others, just we naturally move towards compassion, and naturally move away from harming, because we see it as our own body, so we don't want to harm it. Is that helpful?
No.
Oh well, there's always another Dharma talk by another person at another time. Yeah.
So I'm still back on the moving bridge image.
Mm-hmm.
That was really important for me. When you talked about it, I was thinking of when I was in Nepal, and the images. The reference point for a bridge here moving is very different than the reference if you're living in Nepal and you're trying to get across the stream. The bridges there are moving. There's nothing to hang on to. Mm-hmm. And when you move on that bridge, the bridge moves with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what came up for me with that image is how much our reference shifts with our experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's probably easier in some ways to see that kind of bridge as the self.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This bridge in my mind is always a stone bridge, the Japanese style bridge that with the steps that you walk up one side and down the other, it's very solid and rigid. Thinking of that bridge as moving is a kind of really lovely thing.
I just want to share some thoughts I've had in terms of the separation, and based on our Sunday night class, that discussion around the form and the image in the mirror, and thinking about how the image in the mirror, I mean, just doesn't exist at all separate from the mirror. If nothing's there, it's the mirror. And thinking about how, you know, we're made up of cells, and single cell animals under a microscope, single cells move, but, I mean, in our bodies, single cells, you know, you put them under the microscope, they don't move. And of course, you can take them out and we don't miss them. And like, so it's just, this is an organism, this moves. And in the world itself, too, I mean, all of us, you know, just like this, you know, just really are this world. I mean, and when one leaves, you know, the world itself is not that altered. Or like the floor, you know, the boards, the floor is all the floor, made up of these separate boards, but the floor is the floor. So, anyway, just, it just made sense, you know. It, I mean, at a silent feeling level, that of course things aren't separate that way.
Thank you. I think we need to finish 7:27. Yeah. Any merit that may have come from this discussion, may it help all beings realize their true nature. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.